This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Anyone who has dealt with office politics knows how difficult it can be to get along. A casual observer of our nation's domestic politics clearly demonstrates the impact of the combination of clear differences of opinion with high stakes. We'll now extrapolate that out to relationships with the rest of the world, in which culture and traditions, differences in languages and religions, and concerns of internal and external safety are paramount, and you get an elementary idea of how tricky a nation's foreign policy can be. From our perspective, foreign policy decisions during the Cold War seem relatively easy. One superpower engaged in a delicate dance with another set against the background of the threat of nuclear weapons. Well, today appears to be much more difficult as we deal with actors who are not members of nation states, but who do mean us harm in various unpredictable ways. And that is why our guest today has referred to national security as national insecurity. David Rothkopf is CEO and editor of the FP Group, which publishes Foreign Policy magazine. He is also CEO and president of Gartner Rothkopf. That's an international advisory company specializing in transformational global trends. A frequent contributor to CNN, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and other national publications, he's the author of Power, Inc., Superclass, and Running the World, and his forthcoming book is titled National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. It will be out in October, and David Rothkopf joins us for the hour. Thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure.
He is here, by the way, under the auspices of the World Affairs Council of Charlotte and is speaking at the Charlotte City Club today at noon, which, an affair that gets underway at 11:30, and we have details about that on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks. You've worked in the past for Henry Kissinger. You worked in the Clinton administration as acting U.S. Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade. You're a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. You write for Foreign Policy magazine and all these other publications. Where did this interest in foreign policy come from in you personally?
I don't know. I guess there was never a period in my life where I didn't have it. When I grew up, this was what was discussed around the lunch table, you know, with my parents. And my father was from Europe, and he had escaped the Nazis and come over here, and we would get into lively discussions, which is a euphemism for fights, over, you know, different issues, including Henry Kissinger. Mm-hmm. And I think it just gets in your blood.
No matter who seems to be the president, there are always people pointing fingers at that person because he's the person that leads foreign policy in America, saying he's doing the wrong thing or he's doing the right thing, most often the wrong thing, according to a lot of people. How would you describe the arc of American foreign policy since World War II?
Well, you know, I think for most of the period since World War II through the early 90s, everything was guided by the Cold War. That was what it was about. It was about tensions with an adversary, and the stakes were existential. If they would win, we would be gone. If we would win, they would be gone. And so there was a very clear rule book. You know, it was with us or against us. Mm-hmm. It was a zero-sum game. If we gained a piece of land or gained an ally, they lost it, that kind of thing. What happened in the early 90s when the Cold War ended was we went through a period of kind of euphoria where we said, we're the only ones left. We're the last guy standing. We're the sole superpower, and we're going to get to sort of set up the world. And you remember there were books like mm-hmm. The End of History where people would say, well, we figured everything out, and it's going to be, you know, liberal, small L, democracy for everybody, the American way. But, of course, we discovered that's not what happened. Where we weren't, people stepped in to fill the void. And it wasn't even, you know, that American capitalism had won the day. There are lots of different kinds of capitalism out there. China's developing one kind. Europe has one kind in the north and a different kind in the south. India and Brazil have a different kind. And so we had new forces rising, the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, rising up. And we had new adversaries rising, including non-state actors, which complicate things a lot. That is to say, terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda or this new group, which is now controlling a space in the Middle East, which is larger than the country of Jordan, part of Syria and part of Iraq, this group called ISIS, mm-hmm. Which makes Al-Qaeda look a little bit like a garage band. I mean, it's bigger. It's got more money. It's got more weapons. It's got more recruits. It's got more influence.
You know, when you talk about these books like The End of History, which came out when the Soviet Union collapsed and the Cold War essentially ended, and it's kind of frightening that we could be that naive to not foresee that there would be other actors stepping in to fill the vacuum. It's naive to think, when you look back on it, to think that if we go in and break a country like Iraq, that it's going to be miraculously fixed in a new way by us that will sustain it for hundreds of years to come. Does it scare you that we are this naive?
Well, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, you know, a lot of world history is sort of driven by, not by sort of foreign policy thinking, but by impulses like the triumph of hope over experience. You know, you look at the world and you say, oh, now it's over. Now we've, you know, gotten in touch with the angels of our better natures, and, you know, we're going to move on and do something different and good. And, of course, there has been progress throughout history. But there's a lot of inequality. There's a lot of differences in ideology. There's a lot of frustrations, and that produces new conflicts.
You know, prior to 9/11, we are told that the Bush administration were warned about Al-Qaeda and about Osama bin Laden and ignored the warnings, and that led to what happened on September the 11th. And now we have this new group, ISIS, that you just referenced, which is taking control of big pieces of Iraq. Did we know about them? Is this a surprise to the foreign policymakers in Washington, or what?
Well, you know, I think the answer, the classic Washington answer, is yes and no. We knew about them. They were getting a foothold in Syria 3 years ago. They were a much smaller group at the time. They used the conflict in Syria to grow, to become more like an army, to become more like a government. And then they also began to recruit people. Some of the people they recruited were the generals who got kicked out of the Iraqi army by us, who then gave them military capability. They got much more sophisticated. You know, they have their own social media strategy. They've got an electronic annual report on the web you can go to and look and see what their ambitions are for future conquests. And, it, you know, like in an annual report that exists for a company that says, you know, our sales are up, this one says, you know, our attacks are up. We had this many attacks. We're going to do this many next year. It's really kind of creepy and gives you a sense of foreboding of where things are going. They went into Fallujah in January, and they took Fallujah, the city that we had fought for twice during the Iraq War, and they took it from the Iraqis in January. So we knew that was happening.
And they took it quickly, did they not?
They took it very quickly because almost every place they've gone thus far, the Iraqi army has folded. I mean, the Iraqi army that they fought has sometimes been 25 times bigger than them, but they didn't want to fight and die for this. There was very bad morale. The generals weren't going to go and stand their ground. And so they melted away, whether it was Fallujah or Mosul or elsewhere.
And how do you explain the fact that they've taken a lot of territory that it took America months and months and months to take, and they've taken it in a matter of days?
Well, because America came from the outside world, different perspective. And, you know, the people who were there were fighting for their territory. This is a Sunni extremist group that's gone into the Sunni region of Iraq. Okay. And the Sunnis have been put down by the Shiite-dominated regime in Baghdad, the al-Maliki regime, for so long that a lot of them were like, well, yes, perhaps they're extreme, but they're like us, and they may be closer to our views.
We've lost a lot of American lives in Iraq and Afghanistan, and arguments could be made for and against both of those conflicts, I suppose, and we could sit here and talk about that for days, but we won't. But it seems to me that what's happening in much of the Middle East, and particularly in Iraq now, right now, is a civil war, a religious civil war. So our sending 300 advisors in to help Baghdad stave off this civil war, is that an exercise in futility? Or should we just let them have at it?
Well, first of all, sending 300 advisors in is more of a gesture than it is anything meaningful.
But they are at
risk. They are at risk. But I'm saying in terms of impacting the outcome on the ground, I think it's not going to have a big impact. I guess the core question that you're asking is, you know, is there something at risk for the United States if these conflicts spin out? And the answer, I think, on many levels is yes, definitely. I think we should get past the blame game and talking about the past. What is the situation on the ground now? You now have this army of 10,000 people that is largely comprised of a group of estimated perhaps 7,000 foreign fighters who've come from Europe, who've come from the United States, who've come from elsewhere in the world, initially to Syria, because this was where the action was. This was how they could sort of earn their stripes as extremists, where they've learned techniques on bomb building and learned techniques on fighting. And so we have to look at this on one level as kind of a Petri dish. This is the perfect environment to create new extremists and terrorists. Many of them are not from this region. So when this fight is over, or when they're tired, they're going to go back home. One of the suicide bombers in Syria a couple weeks ago was a guy from Florida. The attacks that took place in Belgium at the Jewish Museum a few weeks ago, two of the people who led that attack had just been fighting in Syria, and then they were in Europe. We have to recognize that one of the lessons of 9/11 is that faraway problems don't stay far away for long in the world in which we live. And so on the one hand, you've got this. On the other hand, you don't have just one. You have actually two civil wars going on. You've got a fight between Shias and Sunnis, but you also have a fight within the Sunnis, between moderate Sunnis and extremist Sunnis. And so these fights go back a long time, right? 1,400 years to the death of Muhammad and the debate over who was going to succeed him. And so the notion that we thought we were going to somehow fix that up with a quick visit into the neighborhood is the ultimate, kind of hubris, right? That there's no way that was going to happen. So what we have to do is we have to say, what do we have at risk and how do we contain that risk? And I think there's, if I may, there's one other area of risk associated, and that is they're rewriting the map of the region. The map, the border between Syria and Iraq is gone right now. But they've also taken over border crossings into Jordan. Jordan is an absolutely vital ally of ours. Jordan is a country that is a pillar of stability in the region. Jordan has a peace treaty with Israel. Jordan is next to Israel. You know, how far into Jordan do they have to go before we think now our moderate allies are at risk, and countries like Israel, with whom we have a special relationship, and I wouldn't underestimate the special relationship with Jordan, are at risk, and we're going to be forced into a different kind of action. We don't want to get there, so I think we need to find ways to contain it.
And at the bottom of this is oil, correct? Is that why we care?
I think oil was initially why we care about the Middle East. Fortunately, we're moving into an era where we're relatively self-sufficient in terms of energy. I think right now oil is a large part of it, but part of it is that small, fragmented groups can get a hold of technology that can project force and do damage around the world in a variety of ways.
But let me ask you this, because it's kind of a mystery to a lot of people, including myself. If we left them alone, if we did not interfere in their internal politics, if we didn't get involved in Sunni versus Shia struggles, would they leave us alone? We wouldn't be an interloper. We wouldn't be a threat. So why would they threaten us?
Well, I mean, I think in 30 seconds, the answer to that is no, they wouldn't, because we do have some interest in the region. We do have allies in the region. They will run afoul of them, and that will draw us into it. Our allies have interests in the region as well.
David Rothkopf is our guest, CEO and editor-at-large at Foreign Policy Magazine, and we will continue our conversation in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and North Carolina's Amtrak, offering travel to 16 North Carolina cities. Tickets, information, and details about summer kids travel at ncbytrain.org. Well, education is a hot-button issue in North Carolina, from how we educate children to how we test them and how we pay our teachers. And we've spoken to politicians about this. We've spoken to policymakers, to journalists, and now we're going to hear from the president of the North Carolina Association of Educators. It's about time, isn't it? That's first in the program tomorrow. And then we meet the man who originated the role of Lil Abner on Broadway as Dogpatch Comes Alive at CPCC Summer Theater. That's all tomorrow, beginning at 9.
the next Diane Rehm Show, primary elections in 5 states and runoffs in Mississippi and South Carolina. Analysis of those results, what they mean for the Tea Party, and the makeup of the next Congress.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and with us in our Spirit Square studio today is David Rothkopf, CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy Magazine and author of a number of different books, Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government, and The Reckoning That Lies Ahead, Superclass, The Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making, Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power, and coming out in October, National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. You've said, and I think you say it in this forthcoming book, that in the past decade, America has crossed the fine line that separates national security from national insecurity, and I take it that's largely due to what happened on 9/11 and our response to what happened on 9/11. Did we overreact to those events in some way?
Yes, I think we definitely overreacted. I think we not only overreacted, I think we misreacted. You know, most countries that face terrorism on a regular basis recognize that terrorists win when you are terrorized. That's their goal. Their goal is a psychological reaction. It's not actually to take down a building or to kill a certain number of people. And we provided that reaction in spades. In fact, by going into the region of the Middle East in such force, with such overreach and such brutality, and setting aside the Constitution and going and creating Abu Ghraib and creating Guantanamo and pursuing rendition and drone strikes and so forth, we've created a lot of these extremists who are out there. We've inflamed them.
Was it in our best interests? Because we created a lot of fear within the country, and we started using the word homeland, which I got to tell you bothers me. I don't know why it bothers me. It sounds scary to me. Maybe that's why they created
it. It's a little creepy. I mean, it sounds Orwellian almost. Mm-hmm. But and it's also very us and them. You know, the notion that somehow there are people out there and they live completely separate lives from us was belied by that. But to sort of build up a wall, it sounds like, oh well, we can create a gated community, United States, shut out the world, go on about our business. And that is unrealistic.
But was it in some people's best interest to create the fear of terrorism, and there are certainly reasons to be fearful of it, but we really, the Patriot Act, et cetera, the National Security Administration, what they've been doing for the past 10 years, is that all because it's
well, I don't think there was like a cabal. I don't think there was a secret meeting where people got together in a room and said, yeah, let's frighten the people and then we'll have bigger defense budgets and we'll be able to go out and pursue things. I think there are a number of people who earnestly believed that there was a threat and that the appropriate way to pursue that threat was through military means and excessive military means, to my way of thinking. And that did lead to a lot of spending in the defense sector, and it did serve a lot of people's interests in the long run. But you know, there was also, for a couple of years after it, most people in a kind of reactive mode. There wasn't a lot of stopping and thinking about this rationally. And if you look at the Bush administration, even when they got into their second term, they realized they overreacted. They got rid of Rumsfeld. They pushed back Cheney. They switched around who they had. They brought in Gates at defense. They started reaching out to allies again. They realized they had gone too far in this period of reaction. And I think what it gets to is, you know, 9/11 was a different kind of an event for the United States. It was the first event in American history where not only were we attacked here, but we were attacked and everybody saw it simultaneously. You know, Pearl Harbor, you read about Pearl Harbor, right? But everybody saw it almost at the same time.
It was on television,
and
live.
And so it was visceral. It was emotional. It got inside of you. And I think that had an effect. But when I talk about sort of the age of fear in that title of the book, It goes from reacting to that and all of a sudden feeling vulnerable in a way that we had never felt vulnerable before and wondering, you know, who else could do this? You know, here were 19 guys who'd taken out 14 acres of lower Manhattan, killed 3,000 people. If they could do it, could somebody else do it? If they're not a country, it's anybody. Well, if it's anybody, and what if it's one guy with a nuclear weapon or with anthrax? Well, if it could be one guy who inflicts this damage, it could be anybody in the world, and all of a sudden everybody became a threat. Well, you can't live your life where everybody in the world is a threat, and we got to that, and that created some of these things. You've talked about the Patriot Act and some of these other things, which was an overreaction, and we started fearing our own reactions because they had gone too far, and then what happened? We had the financial crisis in 2008, mm-hmm. 2009, and all of a sudden our financial system hit the wall and people around the world were going, this is the end of American capitalism, this is excess. And even afterwards, even as we've come out of it, what have we seen? Inequality growing in the United States, the American dream on the ropes. All this stuff causes people doubt and fear. And I think, you know, that's what we have to grapple with. How do we get our arms around it and react to it in a way that doesn't make the fear worse, but actually reduces the risks and enables us to recover?
So what should our response have been? As you say, it was on TV. Everybody saw it live. I mean, we were all wondering why, who, what, what's next? Could it happen again? How do we prevent it from happening again? So what should our reaction have been?
Well, I think within the 100 things we did, there were 20 things we did that were right. You know, so should we harden our assets at home? Should there be more public-private cooperation and vigilance? Should we be more careful about who gets on an airplane, or should we be more careful about who gets a hold of certain kinds of weapons? Yes. So we can make ourselves more secure in that way. When we identify a threat, how do we respond to it? We don't respond to it by invading a region or taking over a country. We've learned one of the ways you do it is with intelligence, identifying the person, trying to identify the bad actors with as much detail as possible. And then there are more surgical tools, drones, special forces, cyber, other measures that allow us to go in and get them without causing great upheaval. So instead of massive open heart surgery on the patient, you go orthoscopically, you know, get in, deal with the specific problem, and get out. And, you know, that's the appropriate way to deal with a non-state actor. It's a lot more a combination of sort of intelligence and police work and public-private partnership than it is traditional state-to-state warfare. But we just fell back into sort of our Cold War mode, and we said, okay, we had one existential threat, the communists. Now we have an existential threat, the terrorists. We're going to treat them the same way, except the Soviet Union had the ability to destroy the planet hundreds of times over. And in 9/11, when the event took place, core al-Qaeda, as it's known, was 100 people. Okay, so all of a sudden, we just sort of, you know, changed the world order in pursuit of a very small number of bad guys.
Why? We have smart people running the government, smart people running the military. Surely they knew that throwing the full weight of the United States military after this was probably going to be terribly expensive and maybe not effective and might stir up a hornet's nest, whereas some sort of a police action and cooperation among nation states to get these people might have been more effective.
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. One of them is there's a natural impulse among politicians and other people whose job it is to protect people that when they've discovered one vulnerability, they start saying, well, this could happen again anywhere. And that would be terrible. We can't allow that to happen. And so they want to go in a sweeping measure against all potential threats. So they overreach in terms of that. Secondly, in terms of the rest of the world, much of the rest of the world was used to terror attacks. They didn't react to this the way that we did. Right. So when we said, call to arms, everybody, let's go in and hit them hard, we didn't get the reaction we wanted. And so people said, well, we can't wait around for the rest of the world. We're the U.S. We're the sole superpower. We can go and impose our will, and we have to do it. And what's more, think about this. You know, 10 years earlier, we had seen the Soviet Union fall. We had seen Eastern Europe go through the Velvet Revolution and those other revolutions. We thought that we had the secret sauce and that when we went into some place, what would happen is that they would, you know, immediately embrace their inner American, run out into the streets and become like us. And, you know, this was a fallacy. But most of the people who were in the Bush administration in the early part of this crisis were trained on Eastern Europe and the Cold War,
right,
and they were making the wrong analogies.
On the other hand, President Obama came in with his hope and change message in 2008, mostly in reaction to the Bush administration and their approach to the aftermath of 9/11. And he's been accused of now leading from behind for not taking the same steps that the Bush administration took in foreign policy in response to that. Many would argue that the hope that he would change America's image in the world has not happened. What's your take on that?
Well, I think it hasn't happened, and I think that it is a fair criticism of President Obama. I mean, you know, we've sort of gone from fear of these terrorists that led us to overreact to fear of ourselves that have kept us from acting at all, and we've gone from the simplistic world of George Bush to the false choices of Barack Obama. So he'll talk about Syria and he'll say, well, what do you want me to do? Put boots on the ground? You know, and then people will go, well, no, don't do that. But of course, that's not our only option. 160,000 people are dead. 9.5 million people are dislocated. It's changing the borders of the region. We are now seeing that it's actually upsetting countries around it in the region. What if we had done humanitarian aid? What if we had given more arms to the Free Syrian Army 3 years ago when ISIS was small as opposed to when ISIS was big?
But we have experience with that too, where we've armed people against foreign incursion like in Afghanistan and against the Soviet Union, and we've seen it come back to bite us.
That's exactly right, and that's why you've got to pick the people carefully. And that's but you know, and by the way, the Free Syrian Army, there were some moderates there. There were some people that we could relate to. But one can also contain the crisis. One could also put the screws on. One could have gone after Assad and said, we're going to take you in the International Criminal Court. You violated, you know, international law. We're going to go after that. There was a whole panoply of things that we could do. And what we said was, A, you know, this, you know, we, because we can't do, you know, we don't want to put troops on the ground. We don't want to get on a slippery slope. We're not going to do anything. And B, we said because we don't see a clean solution, we're not going to undertake anything that might get messy. And here's the problem. The world's messy. There aren't a lot of clean solutions out there.
So would you say with President Bush and President Obama, we have opposite ends of two extremes?
Yeah. I mean, you know what? We have a grotesque political debate in the United States right now. It's a food fight. It is produced huge dysfunction in Washington. George Bush, Barack Obama, both at their core, good men trying to do their job in the best way possible. Very different ideologically, the people around them different ideologically, very different approaches. But if you sort of put all those people in a room and you listen to them and you talk to them, you'd say 95 out of 100 of these people are just earnest, smart, right, Americans trying to make things done. They've taken different approaches. They've become opposite ends of the spectrum, trying to achieve the same thing. But what we don't have is a vision for how we want this world to work, for what our role should be, for how we fix the international system so we don't have to do stuff alone all the time, for how we fix our own system so we can get stronger from within, which we've been getting. It's the opposite of what's been happening. We've been actually getting weaker from within. And I think this is all part of a period that someday people look back and say, 9/11 happened, 2008 happened, and we went into sort of PTSD, post-traumatic shock, you know, through this period, and were very reactive. And hopefully they'll say, and then what happened was America got back on its feet and learned from these experiences.
President Obama had a little impromptu meeting with reporters on Air Force One, in which he outlined his foreign policy approach in one sentence, which I cannot say on the air, so I'll paraphrase it, and that is, don't do stupid stuff. The last word is what I changed. Is that foreign policy?
Well, no, that, you know, there is no one word, there's no one sentence foreign policy. That's not a foreign policy. That is what's in his mind. I mean, it really reveals, you know, for the past 6 years, people in Washington have been trying to define something as the Obama doctrine. Mm-hmm. This is the Obama doctrine. He doesn't want to screw up. You know, he doesn't want to do the bad stuff that George Bush did. And he's been trying so hard to do that that he's actually not addressed certain situations in the appropriate way. Or, for example, take Libya, where we went in because we thought there was a quick way in, a quick way out, a very narrow goal, and nobody thought about what happens next. And right now, Libya is complete chaos. It is, you know, run by the bad guys. You know, it's exactly what we wanted to avoid. But because we thought, well, here's the neat solution, so let's do what's neat, and then let's get out before we get into what's messy, we have now got a situation that's, you know, again, threatening the region and likely to have consequences for us and our allies.
You wrote an article on President Obama's foreign policy in Foreign Policy magazine, and you pointed out several of the president's foreign policy failures and the fact that, quote, not only should we have known better, but there were actually people in the administration who did know better and were ignored. Wasn't that also the case in the Bush administration? Isn't that the case in every administration? And how do we make that stop?
Well, you don't want to make it stop. You want to have a process that allows you to take the best thinking of everybody, present choices to the president, and hopefully have a president who makes the right choices. And in this particular case, we had a process, and particularly in the first term of this administration, you had people who were giving the president very sound advice, not crazy advice about going off to war, but sound advice that was tough enough on the bad guys that you could have avoided some of the meltdowns that we've had since, and was pro sort of a new positive agenda internationally, whether more engagement with Asia, help for women, more help for emerging powers, more collaboration, better multilateral systems. You know, there was a lot of good stuff there. Hillary Clinton, Bob Gates, Leon Panetta, there was a core group there, Tom Donilon when he was the National Security Advisor, who were advising the president in a smart way on this, very often Joe Biden. But there's also kind of a core group around the president, and he's got a very tight inner circle, as everybody has read, and they're sort of saying to him, be true to your inner self. And the inner self is the one who ran against Iraq, and it becomes all about not fighting the last war. It's kind of, generals always fight the last war. Barack Obama was all about not fighting the last war. And that has increased the risk that we actually have future conflicts.
Well, the Cold War, it seems to me, unless it's a very simplistic analogy, but the Cold War was on and off, yes or no, black and white. The good guy, bad guy. And now we have all these other actors around the world that we don't know a lot about. And it's like if we do this, then this is going to happen. It's almost like we don't know what happens. If you take the snail darter out of the ecosystem, you don't know what about that ecosystem is going to start collapsing around us. How do you know? How do you make a right decision?
Well, first of all, you don't know. You know, I think one of the most comical terms in the English language, a real true oxymoron, is political science. Because there's no science about this. You know, there's too many variables. There are billions of variables, and we can't know about all of them. So what you have to do is you have to use your best estimates to get to a situation where you've mitigated risks.
More with David Rothkopf, CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy Magazine, when we come back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and 123NC.com, providing anonymous online access to North Carolina criminal records for background checks on babysitters, coaches, first dates, roommates, and more. Criminal records available online at 123NC.com. On Tuesday, primary elections were held in 5 states in addition to runoffs in Mississippi and South Carolina. Katty Kay guest hosts the Diane Rehm Show today, and her panel will analyze the results and what they mean for the Tea Party and the makeup of the next Congress. That's coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks or Facebook and Twitter. And David Rothkopf is also speaking today at 11:30 at the Charlotte City Club for the World Affairs Council. Tickets are available for that, and you can get information on our website as well. We're coming right back.
I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Duncan McFadden. Thanks for spending your weekend mornings with us.
No need to dress up. You look marvelous. but we'll bring along a company of fascinating, famous, infamous, and new people to share stories and ideas that will lighten and enlighten your week.
It's Weekend Edition from NPR News, Saturday and Sunday mornings from 8 to 10 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. David Rothkopf is our guest. He's CEO and editor of Foreign Policy Magazine, the author of many books, the latest of which is coming out in October, National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. You say that President Obama's approach to foreign policy is, and this actually surprised me, is the essence of conservatism, and that he may be the most prominent representative of the Rand Paul wing of the Democratic Party. People's heads are spinning as I say these words. Explain that.
Well, I mean small C conservatism, not big C conservatism. Right. And so if you say, as you did a minute ago, that he has said over and over again that his foreign policy is don't do stupid stuff, mm-hmm. well, that's conservative, right? You don't want to take risks. I mean, it's conservative in that sense. He's a very, very risk-averse guy. I've heard people who are super close to him say the core thing you have to understand about Barack Obama is he's a lawyer. And he'll go and he'll analyze things in a legalistic way. And if you look at the way decisions have been made in this administration, they're the opposite of Bush administration gut decisions. They are painfully analytical. Now, I'd rather have painfully analytical than wrong gut decisions. So I'm not saying that's fundamentally wrong. But he has been extremely risk averse, and it has gotten us into some kind of trouble. As far as the Rand Paul comment goes, well, Rand Paul and the Tea Party and this whole sort of foreign policy of isolationism, of let's not get too involved in the world, this is a product of this age of fear. This is, a reaction. Well, we got our hands burned. Let's not do that again. We've got problems at home. It's also an impulse that the United States has had since the days of George Washington. We have the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean that isolate us from the problems of the world physically, and it gives us a little more latitude to look inward than other countries do. But we live in a global era, and it's just not feasible to embrace that.
And we are, I suppose, arguably the leader of the world, economically speaking and militarily speaking, in terms of our sheer influence and power, and yet every single time we seem to put our toe in the water, particularly in the Middle East, things go in different directions than we could possibly have anticipated. When he came into office, he went to Egypt, president went to Egypt, and he had this glowing speech in Cairo. Look where Egypt is today. And the Middle East seems to be falling apart. And as you pointed out, I think it was off the air, we ought to be thinking about China. And most of our attention is centered in the Middle East. Are we ignoring China, or are we not paying enough attention to it? And what's at stake there by keeping our focus on these?
Well, I think the Middle East is declining in influence, right? First of all, we're less dependent on the oil and energy from the region. And secondly, if they keep fighting among each other like this, they're going to have less economic clout. They're going to have less influence over the rest of the world. Meanwhile, other parts of the world are growing extremely rapidly. They're developing new technologies. They're building new cities. They're building new infrastructure. They're building new militaries. They're building new alliances with the rest of the world. And that ultimately is where we've got to keep our focus if we're thinking at all in the long term, if we're thinking about the world our children are going to inherit.
And the rest of the world is not America. And we have a very unique position in terms of the way our country was started and in our philosophical approach to running a democracy, that much of the rest of the world outside of England doesn't really share. And so we're over there in the Middle East and elsewhere, and we're supporting crooked regimes that are repressive because it's in our best interest to do so. And then when a civic action takes place, like ISIS crops up and wants to take their country back, we refer to them as terrorists. Are they any different, really, than American patriots were in the American Revolution? I know that that's a very sticky thing to say. I understand that.
It's not sticky. It's like, are there some people who want to take their countries back who are patriots? Yes. Is ISIS like that? No. ISIS is an extremist, fundamentalist group that wants to take the people that they control back into the 13th century, that is, anti-women, that is anti-democracy, that is anti-knowledge, that is anti, all the things that make a society healthy and empowering for the people within
it. But wouldn't that cripple them? If they were able to do that, to the entire region? Would that not cripple the entire region? Would that not take them off our plate of worries?
It might, but is that, you know, the way you would treat your community? If there were part of Charlotte that was a ghetto and it was all fighting all the time and the people weren't being educated and they didn't have any economic opportunity and it was a festering wound in your community, mm-hmm. would you say, fine, that's happening over there, it's not happening where I am, I'm going to ignore it? I think we have to look at the world, and this is, sounds a little idealistic, but it's realistic, as a community.
Let me turn it around.
Okay.
If you're a member of ISIS and you're looking at the evil Satan, the United States, and you look at our permissiveness and the way women are allowed to walk around without the garb, all that, and you look at our media, would you be just as likely to say, well, we need to go after them because they are a festering wound?
You might. certainly the stance that they've taken. I think it's a false analogy between, you know, a patriot who is working to promote progress and a better country, and one that is narrowly pursuing a self-interest that is not in the interest of all the other people in that country or core principles. I don't think we have to go and seek to turn the world into America. And yet reject the idea that tolerance, opportunity for all people, both genders, mm-hmm. Opportunity for people to practice their own religions, you know, these certain basic values be protected to as great an extent as possible.
But they're American values.
No, those are the values of the United Nations. There are values that have been agreed to by nations for a long time. There's, decades and decades of agreement on certain core principles. And, you know, not every nation gets to democracy as fast as one another.
But we support Saudi Arabia, and women can't drive.
Well, that's absolutely a problem. And I think that, you know, we have to use the tools available to us to promote change in those places, because those countries all want something from us, and so we have some degree of influence. And I think we have to look at the world. I mean, look, let's take another example, okay? Adolf Hitler comes to power, and he starts killing off millions of European Jews. Well, that's Europe. Those are European Jews, or European gypsies, or European homosexuals. Do we care about that? Do we care really whether Adolf Hitler's doing that in Europe? We don't want to send our boys off to do that, to get involved, to, you know, expose them to risk. And in July 1940, a public opinion poll took place in the United States, and 17% of the American people said we should be involved in Europe. So the American people didn't want to do it. Right. So it's the exact same situation. So what is it that stirs up within you and says, no, we have to do that? Well, we have certain human values. We have certain connection to other people on the planet. We have learned that if you don't intervene to stop genocide, it will take place. And we've seen it again in Syria. We're seeing it right now in the Central African Republic. We're going to see more of it in Africa with the rise of groups like Boko Haram and so forth. If you don't stop extremism, you're going to have an arc of it that extends from Mali on the west coast of Africa to Indonesia. If these guys get their way, that is not a problem that is remote from us. That is a problem that is going to change the world and millions of people, particularly millions of women who are going to be excluded from society, who are going to be treated like things and possessions, are going to be abused in this kind of a system. Mm. I don't think the United States has the luxury of turning inward and ignoring these things, and I think it's immoral.
Before I switch gears completely and change subjects, I want to share some things that have come in on Twitter and Facebook, et cetera. Bart on Twitter, has anyone considered the possibility of World War III? It was a topic when things hadn't spiraled down as far as they have. Now it seems quite possible. Do you agree with that?
I don't think World War III is around the corner. I do think, however, that if we look at the Middle East right now, the one area that it bears the most resemblance to is the Balkans 100 years ago, where you have situations in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Israel, Palestine, in Lebanon, in Jordan, in Syria, in Iraq, in Iran, in the Persian Gulf, in Afghanistan, that seem unconnected, even in Crimea and Ukraine, that seem unconnected with each other. Mm-hmm. But if we mishandle them and things go the worst way, they'll start connecting. And that's just what happened here. Syria has connected with Iraq.
Larry and Matthew's emails with 9/11, it was often said that we did not connect the dots with ISIS in Iraq. It is not mentioned that we never even saw the dots. We've kind of talked about this, but would you agree with that?
Well, I think we saw the dots, but we didn't reach the right conclusions. The intelligence community didn't predict that this was going to happen. I thought it was a little bit ironic that the first reaction of the U.S. government was to say, well, we'll lend some intelligence help to the Iraqi government. It was like, oh, you mean those guys who missed this the first time? Yeah. But the reality is that we were hoping against hope that this is not what was going to happen. And America, particularly within the administration, had bought into a notion that what our real threat was core al-Qaeda. And all these little al-Qaeda franchises that were out there, because they hadn't blown up something in the U.S., were really a threat only in their neighborhood, and so we didn't have to be as worried about them, and we could let locals take care of them. Problem is, locals were making the problem worse in places like Iraq. Locals weren't up to taking them out or didn't want to in places like Pakistan or places like Libya. And they were recruiting people from around the world who are going to go back to around the world.
Mohammed in Charlotte emails, why is the United States such a staunch ally to Israel, which many in the world of academics and foreign policy would argue is the main source of friction between the U.S. and the Middle East? Is it worth the cost of U.S. lives and billions of U.S. dollars?
Well, I mean, this is just, you know, one of these old saws that's out there. I mean, you can debate whether the U.S. should be supportive of Israel or not, and I think it's a reasonable debate about whether we should be supportive of any country at any given time. But the notion that the U.S.-Israel relationship is the reason for the Sunni-Shia war of the past 1,400 years, or is the, you know, is the reason, you know, that if somehow you solve this, you created a Palestinian state, which we should do, I believe, we have to do that. It's the right of the Palestinians to have their own state. Do you think the day after there's a Palestinian state that these issues are going to stop in the region or the tension with the United States is going to stop? Of course not, because they're far too complicated. Right. They cover far too many issues. And so there's no single, toggle switch we can throw and make things better.
So let's switch gears. You're here to speak about your book, Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. Boy, that'll get your attention. In a nutshell, I believe you say that the rise of private power, as illustrated by the world's largest company, Walmart, by the world's largest asset manager, BlackRock, by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which spends as much worldwide on healthcare as the World Health Organization, that the rise of these private forces may be the most important and least understood trend of our time. Important in a good way, or should we be worried about this?
It changes the equation. You know, the biggest companies in the world have much more economic power and much more global clout than, 100 countries.
And they don't care about nation states, do they? They care about their stockholders.
Well, of course. They're legally obligated to care about their stockholders. That's what they're supposed to be doing. But, in some cases we say, well, let them take care of this problem. But they don't ever take care of the problem in terms of the public interest. They always take care of it in terms of the shareholders' interest. And in some cases, they put their thumb on the scale. And, look at what happened in the climate talks. Look at how environmental issues have been dealt with, in the course of the past decade. Look at how they've influenced trade issues or the issues pertaining to the protection of intellectual property. They've always acted in a way that's predictable, but they have sometimes acted in a way that's contrary to the interests of many people in society. And we need to find balancing mechanisms. But before we do that, we actually have to acknowledge the balance needs to be maintained.
Well, given their global reach and their economic power and the fact that although they may be located in one particular country as their headquarters, like the United States, they're not particularly patriotic because they are looking out for the interests of their stakeholders, shareholders all over the world. Have we moved beyond, or are we in the beginnings of moving beyond, the nation-state model?
I think we're moving to something new in the nation-state model, and I think part of it, you know, nation-states created corporations to serve the state.
Right.
Now
yes.
Corporations are bigger than most of the states. The biggest corporations are bigger than most of the states. ExxonMobil has annual sales that are bigger than Sweden's GDP. Sweden's the 30th largest country in the world, and it's got more foreign offices and more resources for its foreign offices than Sweden has for its foreign service. So it's got more sort of diplomatic clout, you know. That's changing the world. You know what else is changing the world? The fact that in 1990 there were 14 million cell phones, and today there's 7 billion cell phones. And so for the first time in human history, we live in a world in which everybody's part of a man-made system, and they can connect to people across borders as easily or more easily than they can connect to people across the street.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they can form affinities, they can move themselves politically across borders as easily as they once did geographically limited areas like home. And that's going to change our political system for sure.
I have about 35 or 40 seconds. There's several different kinds of capitalism. American capitalism has led the world for years, but there's Chinese, there's European capitalism, and others developing. Are we going to be caught in the middle, or does it matter if our capitalism doesn't win out?
No, I think the tension between the capitalisms produces an evolution in all of the capitalisms. And I think there are things we can learn from capitalism overseas, creating better social safety net, creating better healthcare systems, creating better opportunities for people to rise up, dealing with inequality in more effective ways that will help us. I think they can learn a lot from us as well.
David Rothkopf is CEO and editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. His forthcoming book out in October is called National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. Thank you for the honor.
It's been my pleasure.